From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. And to do that is our panel, which includes Christina Lord, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Nate Eaton, news director at eastidahonews.com, Sydney Kidd, reporter with Boise Dev, and Mia Maldonado, state's politics reporter at the Idaho Capital Sun. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hey, happy Friday.
So, Christina, let's start with you, and let's begin with a judge's ruling regarding the Attorney General's challenge to the open primary ballot initiative. So can you start us off by just refreshing our memories on what that ballot initiative is, and if it passes on Election Day, what it would do?
Yes. So if approved by a simple majority of voters, 50% of voters, I think it's important to understand that Proposition 1, which is what the open ballot initiative, open primaries initiative would be called on when voters get their ballot on Election Day. It would make changes to both the primary elections and general elections in Idaho. The primary takes place in May, while the general takes place in November. And the initiative would end Idaho's closed primary elections by repealing a law that the Idaho legislature passed back in 2011. It would replace closed primary elections with a primary election that is open to all voters and all candidates, regardless of party affiliation. So right now, only the Democratic Party allows unaffiliated voters to vote in their primaries in Idaho. You must be affiliated with the Republican Party to vote in the GOP primary. So if the initiative passes, the top four candidates who receive the most in the primary election would advance to the general election, regardless of that party affiliation. That means that elections could look really different in Idaho. That means that the general election could feature multiple or even all four candidates from the same political party, depending on how many votes those candidates get. And then the Proposition 1 would also change general elections in Idaho by creating a ranked choice voting system, which is sometimes called an instant runoff. Under that system, voters would still vote for their favorite candidate, but they could also have the option of ranking the remaining candidates in order of their preference. So you could pick a second choice, a third choice, and a fourth choice. Ranking candidates would be optional, and it wouldn't be a requirement for voters. But if that candidate doesn't get the majority of votes, then those second, third, and fourth choices would be redistributed and counted again. And then we would keep going through that process until a winner was determined or if a candidate got the majority under that election. So it would change both what we do in May and in November here in Idaho. It would be a different system.
So, Christina, why did the Attorney General challenge this initiative in court?
Yeah, that's a good question. So he, through his legal challenge, Labrador, our Attorney General, Raul Labrador, sought to invalidate nearly 95,000 signatures gathered by the Idahoans for Open Primaries Coalition and its supporters. He essentially alleged that volunteer signature gatherers for the coalition misled the public and fraudulently obtained the signatures used to qualify the ballot initiative for the election. His arguments are that the signature gatherers and the coalition on its website and its other materials didn't clearly state that the initiative would establish ranked choice voting. His argument was that they're only telling voters that this opens Idaho's primaries, but left out that part of the ranked choice voting that would take place in the general elections. But the judge found that the signature gatherers had included the required ballot titles and pertinent information on its petition and in its other materials on its website. And in fact, the judge in his ruling, District Judge Patrick Miller said, that the AG's office itself provided evidence that showed that. And I'm quoting from the ruling here. He said, "The evidence that the Attorney General submits actually negates the idea that the defendants perpetrated false statements to thousands of persons who actually signed the petition." So Labrador also argued that the coalition shouldn't have used the phrase open primaries to describe the initiative, but the judge found that that was an appropriate way to talk about the ballot initiative with voters. So it was a really interesting opinion where the judge basically said even the AG's evidence that he submitted supports the fact that the coalition provided the right information to those who are signing this petition.
So, Christina, so their hearing was earlier this week. The judge ruled in it, ruling in favor of the ballot of this initiative moving forward. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yeah. So what happens now is that the ballot initiative will appear on the November 5th ballot. I think it's really important to say, though, that I don't really think that the story ends there. If the initiative does or doesn't pass, it'll still be very interesting to see how the Idaho legislature responds. You know, we've reported, and I'm sure we've been discussed on this show, that the legislature has a history of bringing bills forward that make it harder to qualify an initiative for the ballot time after time after something does qualify. So the legislators may make another attempt at that. You know, we saw that after Reclaim Idaho qualified the Medicaid expansion initiative that was popular with voters in 2018. They tried to come back and say, we're going to make you qualify more districts. We're going to make you qualify more signatures. So if this initiative does pass, the legislature may also work to repeal it. That's something that I don't think a lot of people understand. Just because the initiative passes doesn't mean that the legislature couldn't go back and say, actually, we're not going to do this. We're going to repeal this initiative. So I think this is really one of the biggest storylines in the November election in Idaho. And we'll watch, you know, as this and some of the ensuing things that unfold, especially as the legislation or the legislative session begins in January. So there's, I think, you know, it will appear on the ballot, but we're still, we'll still be reporting on this, I think, well after the election.
Well, and I think you bring up such a good point, Christina, that, you know, for our listeners to understand, if they don't already know this, is we have a very strict, not policy, I mean, it's the law, right, in place in order to even get something, even to get an initiative on the ballot. It is, I mean, there are a handful of states that do these initiatives. I would argue that we have probably one of the strictest laws in place to try to get this on the ballot. This is not an easy task.
Right. I think we see in states like California and Colorado where voters, every time they go to the polls in November, there are you know, a handful or a dozen ballot initiatives. Washington has a lot of ballot initiatives. But in Idaho, it's fairly rare for a ballot initiative to qualify. And that's because the legislature has instituted these laws that say you must qualify. You know, Idaho has 35 legislative districts. You have to cross a high threshold of those districts with signatures gathered there. You have to qualify an overall number of signatures that is pretty high. So the barrier is quite high already. But inevitably, when things like this pass, we do see attempts by the legislature to then go back and make it even harder after something has made it to the ballot. So we'll see if they make another attempt at that. They've gone to court. The Idaho Supreme Court has ruled that Idahoans have a right to establish their own laws through the ballot, through a ballot initiative. And so there's kind of always this fine line between what the courts think, what the legislature thinks, and then what the actual public thinks.
Well, especially when it comes to a ballot initiative, right? When it is voter and it's 50, you know, more than 50% majority of something passes, and then we have a legislature that comes in and says, well, you know, we're not going to let you do that. So I think you are absolutely right. No matter how this goes, this is not the last we're going to hear of this.
Right. I do think, you know, the legislature would really have to, it'll be interesting to see if it passes or not. If it does pass, it'll be interesting to see by what majority or margin. But if you've gathered 95,000 signatures for a ballot initiative and the legislature comes back and invalidates that, I think, you know, you would really have to ask your legislators, like, why are you going against the will of the voters? Why aren't you paying attention to these issues like Medicaid expansion or like the open primaries initiative? Like, why are you deciding that this isn't right for Idaho when voters are signaling, at least by the signature gathering? And if it does pass, you know, why wouldn't you be taking that into account as a legislator?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. I want to head over to East Idaho, Nate, with you, because Chad Daybell's former home, it has been sold. We know that. You've done some investigating, and it is now owned by a nonprofit organization. So tell us about this and what their plans are.
This is a couple, a local couple in East Idaho, who followed the case closely. And when Chad Daybell, shortly after he was arrested, the home, his attorney bought the home, got the deed to the home, obviously to ensure payment for his services. So John Pryor owned the home, and within a couple of weeks after the guilty verdict and the sentencing came down in June, John Pryor put the home on the market. And there was an immediate interest from several buyers, actually, from what I understand. And it was this local couple that launched a nonprofit simply for this cause to anonymously buy the property. They don't want their names out there. They're not looking for publicity. And their whole intention is to create a place to, I guess they said, create healing for the families of the victims. Now, what that means depends on who you ask. Some people don't want anything on that property. Some people wouldn't mind a memorial. So they're working out those details. They're communicating with the victims' families who are still around. The house closed just a few days ago. And the first thing they plan to do is tear down everything. They want to tear down the home. They want to tear down the shed in the back and tear down the outbuildings. This is a place that, you know, draws tourists and has for the past 4 years. People want to come by and see where those children were buried in an odd way and see where Tammy Daybell died. So it's a property associated with a lot of trauma, a lot of horrible things. And this couple tell me that they hope to really create a place of beauty after this tragedy. What that means is yet to be seen. It's possible this lot sits vacant there for several years until they figure out the next steps.
Yeah. And Nate, speaking of next steps, Chad Daybell's court case, what is the latest with that? Because his defense team filed an appeal recently, correct?
Right. And this is because it's a death penalty case, they had, I believe it was 45 days to file what's called post-conviction relief, where they asked the court to look at the trial, go through the transcripts, and they file explanations for why they feel that maybe the verdict should be overturned or certain parts of the case were in jeopardy. And they went before the judge just a few days ago in Fremont County. That's three appellate attorneys. And they said, "Judge, we simply cannot have this done within, you get 45 days to file it and then 90 days for the entire thing to be resolved." They said, "We cannot have this resolved in 90 days. This is the biggest, most complex case we've ever looked at. There's like 18,000 gigabytes of terabytes of data. I mean, just massive numbers." Those numbers aren't exactly right, what I just quoted, but just an enormous amount of information and data. And on top of that, they're dealing with seven other death penalty cases right now in Idaho. And so they've asked the judge for more time. They seem to hint in their filing that they might be able to have it done within 18 months, their filing, and then there would actually be hearings, perhaps. Just, you know, the beginning steps of the appellate process we've talked about before, Gemma, and you have on your show with other guests about the death penalty in Idaho and how it can be a long, complex battle. And we're just at the beginning of this for his case. But it could be interesting to see what his attorneys come up with as to why they feel he didn't get a fair trial. And if you know, the judge listens to it and it actually proceeds, and who knows what could come of it.
Yeah, no, you're so right. Sydney, let me bring you into the conversation because you have been in Portland all week. I believe you're still over there, right? Covering the FTC Albertsons Kroger case. So give us an update on what's been going on.
Absolutely. Well, there's been a lot going on, and yeah. I'm actually back now. I'm happy to be back. But yeah, we've been in Portland this week. For those who don't know, the FTC is suing or filed a complaint against Kroger and Albertsons because 2 years ago they decided to have, they came to a deal where Kroger would acquire Albertsons. Obviously, these are two major grocery store brands in the area, Kroger owning the Fred Meyer brand and Albertsons obviously owning Albertsons, but they have a bunch of different brands all throughout the country. And the FTC is arguing that if Kroger were to acquire Albertsons, that would essentially create a monopoly. So the hearings that we went to, Don Day and I went to, we heard from both CEOs of the companies testify. We also listened to Albertson's COO testify yesterday. And essentially what the Albertsons and Kroger companies are arguing in court is that that they aren't each other's main competition, that they are, that the companies like Walmart or even maybe a little bit more unconventional companies that we don't think of when we think of groceries, like Albertsons, or excuse me, not Albertsons, Amazon, are more of the competition that these two are dealing with. And they say that coming together would make them stronger against these companies. And the FTC is saying that they believe that Albertsons and Kroger are direct competition. They talked about how Kroger and Albertsons overlap in 22 states and in individual markets where Kroger owns at least 9 stores and the two companies overlap. Albertsons is the first or second biggest competitor in all but 3 of those areas. So there's a lot of argument back and forth about whether or not this would actually be a monopoly. Another thing that the FTC is concerned about is the plan to divest about 579 stores to a company called CNS Wholesale Grocers. And this divestiture is like part of the package of where if these two stores would combine, they would sell off that amount of stores so that they wouldn't have as big of a presence. And the FTC has cast doubt on CNS's ability to actually manage these stores well. So they called in the COO, Susan Morris, from Albertsons to testify on this because she, we learned, is actually going to be the CEO of CNS should this deal all come together. And she would take those 579 stores and run them. So it's a lot of moving parts. She talked a lot about her experience in running stores, in rebannering stores. She said that she felt very confident in being able to run the groceries and that the stores wouldn't just immediately close down, and that CNS would become a grocery competitor. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens because the FTC's got this hearing going on, and then the two companies are expected to also have trials in both Colorado and Washington as well for this deal. So very highly contested.
Yes, I think that's a good way to put it, Sydney. And if folks really want a more in-depth, go to BoiseDev.com because Sydney and Don Day have been covering this really thoroughly. And Sydney just gave a great recap, but a lot more detail in all of that reporting. So Mia, you've been following a court case regarding Idaho transgender inmates and whether or not they can receive gender-affirming care. First off, can you tell us about House Bill 668, what it was, and what this bill did once it was passed?
Yeah. So House Bill 668, it was passed this year during the legislative session. And what it does is it prohibits state funds and facilities from providing gender-affirming care. So puberty blockers and hormones and other, treatments. The law doesn't specifically name transgender or non-binary people, but it says public funds can't be used for, quote, purposes of altering the appearance of an individual in order to affirm the individual's perception of the individual's sex in a way that is inconsistent with the individual's biological sex, end quote. So it's very specific, and people in opposition to this law said, like, this is targeting transgender people. So during the session, it received a lot of opposition from LGBTQ plus advocates. There were several people, including a dad whose child is on Medicaid and receives gender-affirming care, who opposed it because, you know, Medicaid is publicly funded, so the law would impact them. While legislators said this is just, you know, we don't want our tax dollars going towards something we don't support. So that's kind of the two sides. And then in June, a lawsuit was filed by the ACLU of Idaho just 3 days before this law was supposed to take effect or took effect. It's still in effect. And it was filed on behalf of two transgender women in Idaho prisons who sued the state of Idaho, alleging it violates the Eighth Amendment. And the Eighth Amendment protects against cruel and unusual punishment. And so they're arguing that gender-affirming care is necessary, and by taking, and this law is taking away from that necessary care. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with that said, Mia, this case was in court, and on Tuesday, a federal judge made a decision. So tell us about that, and so what that's now done to House Bill 668.
Right. So on Tuesday, federal judge David Nye, he granted the lawsuit a preliminary injunction and class action status. So first, what that means is a preliminary injunction, it blocks the law from taking effect. But what's unique is that the class action status that allows the law to block the blockage of the law to affect not just the two plaintiffs involved, but everybody who is or will be diagnosed with gender dysphoria in Idaho prison. So the class action status, it creates like a certain class that's protected throughout the remainder of the lawsuit. So people with gender dysphoria in Idaho prisons can remain seeking gender affirming care for the remainder of the lawsuit. A little bit more about what Judge Nye said in his decision is he said the plaintiffs, they do raise serious questions going into the merits of their case. And they do show that they would experience, you know, irreparable harm if this law were to be enforced to them. And he referenced past Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and he said, you know, the government does have an obligation to provide medical care for those whom it is punishing by incarceration. And, you know, indifference to the needs of prisoners is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. So the law, the next steps are in this case are litigating the merits of that Eighth Amendment claim. There are no new court dates that have been set as of now, but the law is still in place for non-incarcerated people in Idaho. But yeah, that's the update as of Tuesday.
Okay, well, thanks for that update. Appreciate that. As we move on, Christina, the Idaho ballot for November's election is finalized. I mean, at least a part of it when it comes to who will be running for president. Now, most people think, well, we know who's running for president. Kamala Harris, Donald Trump. Not necessarily. We've got some more options for Idaho voters.
That's right. So we're really getting into the swing of election season. So we're seeing certain deadlines approaching relating to that election. And on Wednesday, the Idaho Secretary of State's office, which is the entity that oversees elections in Idaho, announced that 9 presidential candidates, including 5 independents, have qualified to appear on Idaho's November 5th general election ballot. The deadline for independent candidates to make it onto the ballot was September 1st, and the deadline to withdraw is actually today. You know, so like you mentioned, we have the candidates that most people know, Kamala Harris for the Democrats and Donald Trump for the Republicans, but independent candidates like Jill Stein and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. did qualify for the Idaho ballot. Although Kennedy has officially announced that he's dropped out of the race and has endorsed Trump, Kennedy has said that his campaign will work to remove his name from state ballots, especially focusing on swing states. You know, Idaho's not a swing state, but we'll be checking to see if he or his campaign made an effort to remove himself from the Idaho ballot after today. And then I think there's just some other voting related deadlines that listeners may want to keep in mind. October 11th is the last day to register to vote online, although Idaho does have same day voting registration at the polls. If you bring an ID and your proof of residency, early voting begins in most counties on October 21st, and October 25th is the last day that you can request an absentee ballot. So there's still time to get registered to vote. There's still time to request your absentee ballot. But we're getting really into the thick of things here with the election season, so keep those deadlines in mind.
Nate, let's talk about an incident that happened in Island Park over the weekend. This was a grizzly bear attack. And I mean, this individual who was attacked, certainly lucky to be alive.
Yes, and I can tell you that I have some new information because we just interviewed the hunter who was there with his friend. We haven't even posted the story And they sat down with our reporter David Pace for 2 hours and told their story. They were hunting near Henry's Lake. It was around 7 a.m. on Sunday when an adult male grizzly came up and started to attack one of the young men. The other one started firing a gun at the bear, and then the bear turned and went after the one with the gun. And that's when the man who was originally being attacked pulled out a gun and started firing at the bear. At one point, the bear had one of them by the arm and was swinging him in the air for about 30 seconds. And they told us that it took 24 shots to get the bear down, and that the bear just, you know, was coming after them, and it was pretty aggressive attack. But finally, they were able to kill the bear, and now the Idaho Department of Fish and Game are investigating it. We'll have that entire interview a bit later this afternoon on eastidahonews.com for those of you that want to hear it. But it's an incredible story of survival. Both men were okay in the end. They were taken to the hospital in Idaho Falls, but they've since been released. And it took them a couple of days to share their story. They've been shaken up all week, but pretty miraculous story of surviving that attack.
You know, Nate, one of the things that struck me as I read the article that you posted is the number of grizzly bears growing in that part of the state. So talk to us a little bit about that, in particular about what a state official said. It's the first time they've seen a grizzly bear cross a part of I-15. So they've usually been on one side of that, but now they're seeing them on the other side.
Yeah, I was also surprised to hear this. It's been quite a busy year in eastern Idaho and Montana, Wyoming, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is what they call it. There's more than 1,000 grizzly bears in the region. And the first time that one of the bears was documented to be west of I-15. They've normally stayed on the east side of the interstate, and they have been able to track one west of I-15. They're saying the population is growing, and there's a lot of cattle in the area, in that western part of I-15, but also on the eastern part. And there's been this cattle conflict happening all year. And this happens every year, but it seems like it's been more this year, where the bears will go after the cattle, and you have the farmers that want to protect their livestock. And so it's an issue, you know, this is a decades, centuries long issue about the grizzly bears. They are still protected under the Endangered Species Act. So you cannot go out and kill a bear just simply to kill it. But, you know, this has been one of those debates about the bears in the region. And they are telling anybody that goes out still to this day, if you're going to go out in groups, have the bear spray, have travel in large groups, make noises, do what you can to prevent yourself from possibly being attacked.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you for that update. Christina, before we go into break, tell us a little bit about the America 250 initiative. We've talked about it here on our program before, but how folks can get involved. And this is pretty neat, I have to say.
Yes, we're so excited to be able to talk about this one. The Idaho State Historical Society and other agencies are already very hard at work planning to celebrate the United States' 250th birthday in 2026. And there's some great ways that nonprofits, local governments, other agencies can benefit from some funding that's becoming available to help with these celebrations. So the Historical Society just announced that grants are available between $5,000 and $25,000 for things like capital projects, accessibility, sustainability, historical preservation, and educational projects. Like I said, nonprofits, local city, county governments, and Idaho tribes are especially encouraged to apply for these grant opportunities. And people and organizations can also apply to get help recording oral histories through the state. Through the application process, the initiative will provide Idahoans with access to Their Story Inc., which is a really cool oral history software subscription that makes it very just a lot easier to collect people's stories. And I talked with the state historian who is really hoping that people will show up for this oral history project. She said that, like, you know, a lot oftentimes when we talk about U.S. history, it's kind of told through the North versus South storyline or lens. But Idaho and the West isn't an afterthought to the American story, she said. She said, we are a critical component of the making of modern America, and our stories deserve to be included in this celebration. The deadlines to apply for both the grants and the help for the oral history project is September 30th, so it's coming up. But we'll see a lot more information coming out about these efforts and some of the local celebrations that people are planning. I really love history, so you'll definitely see some coverage at the Idaho Capital Sun about some of these projects and what they mean for the celebration of our country.
Well, I'm right there with you on that. So, Christina, even though there isn't the robust data around COVID anymore, there is a site that people can go to get information.
Right. So there's no longer daily case counts like we saw at the beginning of the pandemic. However, there is the federally required hospitalization data, which stopped in May, is set to return in November. So we'll be able to show how much our health systems are being strained or not by the virus again, which will be interesting to follow. But really the biggest indicator we have about how COVID is circulating in our state is from our wastewater reports. It's a bit funny to think about, but some of the most accurate reports come from our poopy water. So when we go to the bathroom, the virus is shed into the wastewater system, and there are wastewater monitoring for COVID in three areas of Idaho, including here in Boise, that the CDC tracks. You can find this national wastewater map on the CDC's website. I just looked this morning, and the map shows very high levels of COVID in Idaho right now, as of today, and also very high levels in our neighboring states of Oregon and Wyoming, and definitely in other parts of the United States. But that's where it's showing up the most closer to home.
Mm-hmm. And new COVID vaccines are available, and we should be seeing them here in Idaho soon.
Correct. Yes, they're rolling out across Idaho as we speak. People are starting to make appointments at their doctor's office or pharmacy now. For our story, we interviewed Dr. Christine Hahn, the Idaho State epidemiologist, who said there's a spike in COVID rates across the state. Obviously, nothing like we saw or experienced during the height of the pandemic with strained hospitals or anything like that. But there are more cases right now. So if you are at high risk of complications or if you plan to travel soon, Dr. Hahn really encouraged that you get your COVID vaccine now. Something else that I think is interesting is that Americans can order free at-home COVID tests again through covidtests.gov at the end of September. So it's sometimes nice to just really have those on hand if you're going to go make a visit or if you're feeling ill, to just take an at-home test to know where you stand. And then I've seen this question a lot on social media, on Twitter and things like that. But as for your flu vaccine, those are also available right now. But Dr. Hahn and Dr. David Pate, the former CEO of the St. Luke's Health System, really suggested waiting up for about a month to get your flu vaccine. That's because if you get your flu vaccine too early, its protection can wane and wear off by the height of flu season, which can hit in January and February. Mm-hmm. So they emphasize get your COVID vaccine now, wait for the end of September or early October to get your flu vaccine, just so those protection windows are kind of lining up with when most of the cases for these viruses show up.
Mm-hmm. So, Nate, the INL's new sample preparation lab is the first hot cell facility in almost 50 years. Can we just start with, what is a hot cell lab?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think a lot of us wonder the same thing. It's basically a specialized facility that allows the researchers to handle and study radioactive materials. So they're actually, you know, inside these highly protected cells and that are shielded, and they can interact with radioactive material. You would obviously need a very high-tech building like that to handle this type of material. But earlier this week, Congressman Mike Simpson was here in Eastern Idaho, where they did a ribbon cutting on this facility. It was announced back in June of 2020. It should begin operating next year. It's the first hot cell facility, as you mentioned, at the INL in nearly five decades. They've been working on it, though, for many years. What it's going to do, they're going to focus on irradiated materials, according to the INL director, and it's going to help the researchers understand existing materials that are currently in nuclear reactors, how they operate, how they'll perform over time, and then hopefully understand as things advance about how they can use that knowledge in future developments. It will bring jobs to Eastern Idaho. It was a $166 million project, and it's a pretty big deal for the INL.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mia, most of our state's energy is through hydroelectric power, but you recently reported on the fact that we're starting to see some movement in that. Can you explain what other options we're starting to see?
Yes. So a little background on my story. Each year, the Idaho Governor's Office for Energy and Mineral Resources releases a report that looks into how the state is getting its energy. And what I did is I looked at the earliest reports on the website and compared that to this year's report. And what I found was, you know, Idaho is still really rich in electricity, but what stands out is that in 2009, 80% of our electrical generation came from hydroelectricity. And in 2024, that number was 45%. So at first glance, that sounds really alarming. I was definitely alarmed when I first saw that. And my first thought was, is drought that bad? So I spoke with energy experts and they told me drought is definitely a factor that impacts our hydro generation. But also in Idaho, we've developed a lot of new energy technology, especially other renewable resources like wind and solar over the years. And those are more environmentally friendly, that's also just because they're the lowest cost way to produce energy. In 2011, solar, it wasn't even listed as a generation source in that report, and wind made up 1.9% of our generation. And then in 2024, wind and solar combined made up 20% of our generation. So if you think of a pie graph, that's almost a quarter of the pie. So that the number of those renewables has gone up. So as we're adding that new technology, hydroelectricity is just becoming a smaller piece of the pie. And also our usage of natural gas has increased. So when there's less water, no sun or no wind, for the most part across Idaho, natural gas is the resource that carries our electricity and it's a really good backup.
Well, I appreciate that report. Sydney, I have less than a minute left, but I'd love for you to quickly tell us what is going on with Boise's well-known Big City Coffee Shop. They're in the middle of a lawsuit in court and they've closed their doors.
Yes. So they closed their doors. This is a story that Margaret Carmel reported on earlier this week after 24 years. And another local company is going in to take over and to it'll be their third location. So I know we're short on time. I guess I'll just say if you're interested and you want to read more about it, check out boisedev.com. And we've been covering the court case and Idaho Ed News has also been covering it.
Yeah. And that's why I really wanted to make sure we got that in there, is because this is a court case a lot of people have been interested in. Boise Dev, of course, has been covering that. But also go to everyone's websites who we've had on today. We have phenomenal journalists here. So a big thank you to Christina Lords, Mia Maldonado, Nate Eaton, and Sydney Kidd. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.